Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Tom Antonio of the Native Plant Society of New Mexico about their upcoming conference and annual meeting. We are talking this morning about SOFA West. It is the third annual International Sculpture, Objects, and Functional Art Fair at the Santa Fe Convention Center this Thursday through Sunday, the 4th through 7th of August. And I'd like to welcome to the program artist Ramona Sacchiestua and artist Joanne Teasdale and gallery owner David Eichholz of David Richard Contemporary Gallery. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks.
So all of you are participating in SOFA West in one way or another. Ramona, let's start with you. You do Native American fiber work. You do works on paper. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to right now.
I have transposed my weaving into now constructed and deconstructed works that I do as monoprints on spun fiber, which is kind of like pelon or weed barrier that you put around plants. And I do monoprinting, then I pull those prints and I deconstruct them and reconstruct them in little constructions and sometimes put gold or silver leaf on them.
And so are the designs related to the designs from your textile art?
My textile art was really very much about layering color, and so this is just another foray into how to layer color for me. But it's much more gratifying because it's sort of instant work versus labor-intensive years of weaving or weeks or months of producing an image.
You have been an artist since you were a small child. How did you start weaving, and were you working in Native traditions from the beginning?
No, I'm actually a self-taught person. Somebody gave me a sewing machine when I was 4. I started sewing and making clothes for myself by the second grade, which were pretty horrific, but nevertheless, I thought they were fabulous. And then I started looking into traditional weaving in this area. And then from books, I taught myself how to weave and just did a lot of research and exploration and kind of the scholarship of traditional weaving in this area.
What were some of the traditional elements that you used, and then how did you depart from them?
Weaving in the American Southwest was really prehistoric Pueblo. Both sides are finished. I think people recognize it more in Navajo weaving. Certainly in European tapestry, you get one sort of flaky side and one perfect side. And so I adapted all of the traditional techniques that come out of prehistoric textiles into contemporary weaving. But the designs and patterns are based on my own watercolors and my own designs.
So you start with watercolor, which is such a painterly medium, and then translate that into weaving, which is so really vertical horizontal.
It's very pixelated, but that was part of the challenge, was getting the layered color to come through, because it's not just one shot or one pick across the loom. It's bundles of different colors of yarn, so you see depth of color.
Are you working with traditional materials like wool and natural dyes and things like that?
I started out with that, and then I moved into doing some very large commissions that were done in rayon silk, gold leaf thread, and I've worked out of this country on projects where we use traditional materials from those other countries.
What have been some of your more interesting commissions?
I did a series for Kenneth Nolan based on his paintings, which was pretty interesting because you're translating the work of a living artist, so there's a collaborative component to it. I did a series of tapestries for the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, which was trying to interpret work of a deceased person, a famous deceased person, in the best way that represented their work, not put yourself in it necessarily. And then I did a very large theater curtain for the National Museum of the American Indian that's 60 feet by 20 feet.
What
which
was
is
that
my
made
largest.
Of?
That was made out of silk and rayon, hundreds of pounds of silk and rayon and gold thread.
Does it have a traditional design on it? Or?
No, it represents the diverse sort of storytelling history of the Inupiaq and Northwest Coast tribes, and it is more representational. It has ravens that are flying over ice and snow, and a moon sort of descending into the ice scape. And storytelling is traditionally done at night in the winter, and the ravens represent the six directions, and they're also the tricksters and storytellers of that region.
I suppose it's one of those rare places where you hope the curtain doesn't go up for a while.
Well, yes, you do. It's pretty beautiful, but that's its function, is to be a curtain.
I think there's a long tradition of artworks like painting being translated into tapestries. I've seen a Picasso painting translated into a tapestry and things like that. What's the history of that?
Well, early on, tapestry weaving really was representational work when there was no photography, and it was a culturally specific expression for big halls, for big architectural elements. And then some people continue to do photographic kinds of imagery. I choose really to do abstract work because I just like, again, what you can produce in the medium.
And now doing work that you call, what did you say, instant gratification?
It's instant gratification, yes.
You can also, I would imagine, really play with the designs and correct mistakes and add things as you wish.
It's actually more about mistakes. It's just more about the exploration and assemblage of color and layers of color. It's just very satisfying to me.
So you are being represented by 8 Modern at SOFA West, by 8 Modern in general here in Santa Fe, but and also at SOFA West. Tell us a little bit about the work that you will have at the exhibition.
I have some small constructions done in Rime and Pellon that are both clay and acrylic printed, but they're mono print fabrics that are then arranged and sewn together and then leafed.
And mono print means it's a print, but there's only one of them.
There's only one of them.
So let's turn now to David Eichholz. You are the owner of David Richard Contemporary, and you've been exhibiting at SOFA for quite a while.
Well, actually, we've only been in business for about a year and a half. But
oh, is
we've
that
done,
right?
Yeah, this is our second SOFA West, and we were at SOFA Chicago and SOFA New York.
So tell us about the gallery. I didn't realize it was such a new gallery. How did you get it started, and what kind of work are you showing?
Well, I've been a collector for many, many years, and I decided we've been living out here, commuting back and forth to St. Louis and to New York, where we used to live, for about 8 years, and had always wanted to open a gallery here. And what we want to have always wanted to focus on is abstraction, which is sort of interesting with her work as well. But so what we focus on is mostly paintings and sculptural objects. And that's why what we're going to be showing largely at SOFA will be the sculptural work, which are mostly of glass, bronze, and stone. And but we're going to be mostly featuring our glass artists at this exhibition at SOFA. But we work on contemporary work as well as works from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So we have pretty much bracket that area and focus on hard edge, geometric, optical abstraction. So it's non-referential abstraction.
Is that the work that you also collected during your long period as a collector?
Oh, yeah. I've always, Richard and I both have always liked hard edge, geometric, color field, gestural abstraction, just non-referential sort of work.
And what's it like to go from collecting to being a gallery owner and dealer?
Not a lot different in terms of your selection and what you like. You just get to spend more time with the artist, and we represent a number of living artists. In fact, most of our artists have been working since the 50s and 60s. They were, you know, key parts of art historical movements and tendencies back in the 60s and 70s, but they're still producing and still producing very wonderful work. So that's what's really nice, is to work with these people that have this long trajectory and this large body of work. And it's just very fun to meet their friends and colleagues, and that's how we end up curating a lot of our shows. It's a lot around things that were happening, like the show that we have up right now is Southern California Painting from the 1970s. We're really largely focused on the LA-based painting from the 70s. So we curate very specific exhibitions as well as solo exhibitions.
I would think that when you're a collector, you're acquiring stuff, and when you're a dealer, you're having to let it go in a way that you didn't before.
Oh, it's painful to see some things go and to really talk to people about them and know they're going to be buying them. But it's fun. It's great to I don't know if it's a cliche, but it really is fun to help people build a collection. And it's really fun to work with people who get as excited about the work as you do and really like the history of the artist and really like all their touch points and connections with other artists, with other movements, with other geographies. And so that's what we like to do, is work with that history and help people build these collections that have a history. And so it's not like you're... And the nice thing about with the collectors is you never... Rarely do you sell just one piece to somebody. You see the people over and over again. You see their collections. You go to their homes. You kind of become friends and colleagues just like you do with your artist. And it kind of creates this almost like a family. And many of our artists meet our collectors and vice versa. And so you don't really ever... It may not be in our possession anymore, but you don't ever not ever see it again. You see that work again. But in context, which is fun.
Who are some of the artists whom you show?
Well, we represent Judy Chicago. We're also representing Beverly Fishman. At the SOFA exhibition, we're going to be representing... We represent a number of people. We'll be showing there Yoko and Takeshi Sano. Thomas Schoon in our gallery during that weekend. We'll be having solo shows for Tutsinski and for Philip Baldwin and Monica Guggisberg, a husband and wife team from Paris. A number of other painters are Gerald Birchman, so quite a few different people.
Now, what are the characteristics of a good collector and a good collection? Does it help a collector and a collection to really focus on one specific area and time and place, or are your collectors all over the place? They're collecting a little bit of Mexican art and a little bit of American art and paintings and sculptures and so on?
Well, they're a little bit of both. Most collectors, though, are pretty specific about what they really like, and they seek you out, especially when you're fairly specialized like we are with American post-war abstraction. They seek you out, and we run into them at the different exhibitions that we do around the country and art fairs. But most of them are pretty targeted in terms of what they like. But the way they put it together, even though you may have 10 different collectors collecting the same artist, how they put it together with other artists, it becomes very personal and very unique to them. And that's what's actually nice about it. Rarely do you see the same collection ever pulled together, even if there's a lot of the same artists, because people are inspired by different color, time periods.
It's a funny thing that, I mean, art is obviously a form of expression and an expression of its time and so on, but collecting, I learned this a long time ago when I was in college, that collecting is also its own form of self-expression in a way.
Oh, definitely. And same with curating. I think curators have become, in some ways, have a lot of notoriety anymore because of the way they pull shows together. And there's definitely an art to it. In terms of how you create these relationships that when people walk in, they get it. And that's a successful collection, that's a successful curation of an exhibition. When people walk in and they see what the point is you're trying to make or the relationship you're trying to make, versus when people walk in and go, I don't get it. That's not a good thing when you're a curator. You hate to hear that.
Right, what's going on here?
But collectors, you know, are very unique, and how they build their collections around their homes or lifestyles is also very unique. So it is very fun. That's the part of the job that I really, really like, is helping people build that.
So you will be at SOFA West, which is what we're talking about this segment. SOFA stands for Sculpture, Objects, and Functional Art. It's a big event at the Santa Fe Convention Center this weekend, Thursday through Sunday. There's also a preview. We'll talk about that in a moment. Let's turn to Joanne Teasdale. Now, you are an artist. You work with photography. You do glass work. You do oil painting. And there is a real connection among those three media for you. It's so hard to see things on the website, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing your work in person at SOFA. But I was looking at these oil paintings on your site, and I thought they were photographs.
Yes, they are very photographic. I'm inspired by photography. I do it. And so there's a real synergy between the photography that I do, the painting that I do, and in the last 3 to 4 years, the integration of glass into the body of work that I'm creating. So they all influence each other, and they influence the way, for example, the quality of the glass. When I fuse an image into the glass, and its quality will influence how I will use the camera later on when I'm out there in abandoned buildings where I spend a lot of my time. I will think about the glass and how it will look into the glass, or how it will look onto a painting, and vice versa. They all sort of create a big synergy, and there's a definite signature between the three.
So when you, for example, the first thing I looked at of your work on your website was the oil paintings. Do you work from photographs? Do you start with a photograph?
Yes, I do, from many sometimes. I mix them together. I edit a lot of the photographs. Because I don't have to do it with Photoshop, I can simply do it with my hand. So I go out and I take photographs out there. I also hire models, so I work with them and I will superimpose these images. Yes.
And it was funny. Some of the oil paintings look so much like photographs, but then some of the photographs look a lot like painting.
They do. They do. I can't seem to not fuse everything together, not to make a pun here.
Right.
Yeah, they are. So that's why I think there's this definite signature with what I do. I'm drawn to it. When I do photography, I've made some filters out of scratch plastic to create a certain diffusion of light. And so the image will appear differently. I do a lot of close-ups of abandoned
structures. You actually scratch plastic?
I do.
Yourself, like with sandpaper or whatever,
yeah.
And put it over the lens of your camera.
And that's right.
Very interesting.
Or I'll just, another old trick is just, if it's cold a little bit outside, you just create, with your breath, you create a fog over your lens. So I've done that as well. I photograph a lot of institutions. I've been to prisons. I've been to reformatories. I have been to asylums in Europe and here.
I don't know if this is something that you can speak to, but what's the attraction of those kinds of spaces for you?
It's about the imprint of our passage. And I don't just do these institutions. I also do, I will also go to abandoned buildings. And we'll talk about this in a minute, but the work at SOFA is about that. It is about what's left behind and the traces of our passage and what we have created, even though we're no longer there, we as humans. And I'm there to capture that, to not only document it, but also to feel it, and to then later put it into painting and glass and reformat it or superimpose the imagery in order to create a work of art based on my feeling and what I see in these places.
When I was looking at them, I saw not only what you're describing, the imprint of people who have been there, but also the imprint of nature itself, the spiders who made all the webs, and just the physics of decay.
Right. Yes, there is that. And there's beauty in it, but there's also a lot of history in it. And that history is something that matters to me a lot. I'm a sort of an amateur ethnologist in a way, from an artistic point of view, if you will.
Now, you are French-Canadian from Montreal.
Yes, I am.
Have you also been an artist since you were a small kid?
No, I'm actually self-taught as a painter. 11 years ago, I tried it, and it worked.
Really?
Yeah, and then self-taught as a photographer as well. For glass, it took some workshops in order to understand the the technical part of it. And Bullseye Gallery, who has also a glass center in Portland, taught me what I needed to know.
Tell us about the glass work that you do.
The type of imagery that I use?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at some examples of it, and again, it looks like there are photographic images somehow incorporated into it.
Yeah, well, there are different ways that I do incorporate the imagery. Technically, the way it's done, I will kiln form the glass first, give it a shape or fire polish it, and then I will apply a film onto which has been printed my image. I send the image to a company in New Jersey, and they print it on a special film that will blend or fuse with the glass. So I apply the film, and then I will use the kiln to fire this this film onto the glass. It will fuse with it. So when you touch the glass surface, it is in there. And so I use this technique just to incorporate the image. But then I will put the piece with the image into, for example, an apothecary jar to create an encapsulation. I've also created an accordion book with different images on it called Encapsulation as well. There was a theme going.
An accordion book of Made of glass.
Yes, and it's 12 inches.
Is this going to be there?
No, it's going to be in my studio. But okay. There's a VIP tour. It's going to be there for that. And it's 12 inches high by 41 inches. It's a fairly large book. Yes, and I've also cast glass and incorporated images into the castings as well. I've also made big murals out of panes of glass with part of the imagery. In each pieces of glass, up to 25 pieces. So, I work in different sizes. It's mainly flat, but it has also relief.
Joanne Teasdale is an artist, and Ramona Sekiestewa, also an artist, who will both be represented at SOFA West, and David Eichholz, owner of David Richard Contemporary. Now, a little bit more information about SOFA West. First of all, they are at sofaexpo.com. This is a gigantic show that is even more gigantic in its incarnation in Chicago, which takes place a little later in the year. So the hours of the fair at the Santa Fe Convention Center are noon to 6, Thursday through Sunday, August 4th through 7th. There's also an opening night preview on Wednesday, the 3rd of August. It's open to the public from 7 to 9 p.m., and people can check the website for more information about that. Also new this year, there is a spotlight presentation of the Intuit Show of Folk and Outsider Art, and that is also happening at SOFA West. I don't know too much about that yet. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about it a little bit more this week, but in any case, check it out. It's a wonderful event for the Santa Fe community, and I want to thank all three of you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Dr. Tom Antonio. He is science coordinator at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and he is president of the Native Plant Society of New Mexico, which is having its annual conference and meeting this week, Friday through Sunday at IAIA. I'd like to welcome you to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So you are the president of this Native Plant Society. Talk for a moment about native plants. What do we even mean by native plants?
Well, what we mean by native plants are those plants that are found that occurred naturally in New Mexico. I mean, there are native plant societies in almost every state. And ours deals primarily with plants that grow here, those that haven't been introduced. They're not cultivated. They're not weeds. These are the plants that were found here before people actually got here.
Do plants migrate? I mean, obviously, they don't migrate as much as animals or people, but do they migrate at all?
They do migrate. I'm thinking about the plants that most of the plants that we think about that migrate are weeds. Okay, weeds come on. They came with the pioneers on the wagon wheels. They came on the hooves of horses. They've come in bales of straw or seeds. Different weed seeds have been put into this. So there's lots of different weeds that were found that are found all over New Mexico that are not native here. I mean, we could talk for hours on the weed problem in New Mexico, but we try to focus on the native plants. I mean, we like to talk about how to get rid of some weeds, but really want to promote the native plants and how they're used in landscaping, how they're more water tolerant, how they're more beautiful, how they have a genetic memory for this area, so that we don't really promote cultivated plants, the plants that you find mostly growing in nurseries and stuff like that. There are a number of native, wonderful native plant nurseries in Santa Fe and around the state, and we promote those plants.
What do you mean by genetic memory?
Well, these plants have been around a long time, and they have gone through droughts, much like the one we're going through right now. So they know how to survive through that period. They know that if it's going to be very dry this year, we're not going to get very large. Okay, we may not produce as many seeds. We may not produce as many flowers. So the plant essentially knows how to live in that environment for having done it in millennia.
There is a lot of discussion and a lot written about destructive non-native plants. And then I imagine that there are some rather benign non-native plants as well.
Right. We have members that are on both sides of an extreme of that. Some who don't want any non-native plant in their garden, don't want to promote non-native plants at all. Then we have other members who are quite willing to accept drought-tolerant plants, even if they're from some other part of the country or the world, that can be brought in here. As president of the Native Plant Society, I actually just focus on the local native plants. But if I had to be truthful, in my own yard, I do have drought-tolerant plants that are not from New Mexico. I will confess that. It's official. I will confess that. Because it just happens, you know.
Well, I mean, I was watching a documentary once about native food, and if we were to eat only the foods that were native to North America, what would we be eating? You'd just be like five things.
Right. Yeah. Maybe sunflowers and, you know.
Right, tomatoes.
Cranberries. I mean, it'd be
exactly.
Not much.
So what are the most, for gardeners, the most popular and beautiful native plants?
Well, if I were to choose one group that people should focus on, in at least in the Santa Fe area, it would be the penstemons. They are, without a doubt, one of the most drought-tolerant, more interesting groups of plants that you can grow. There's a different variety of sizes and colors. There's a whole penstemon society, actually, that revolves around these plants and promotes them. But New Mexico is home to a number of wonderful, beautiful penstemons that would do well in just anybody's garden. I actually have a penstemon in my yard that I have overwatered. And I live off the grid in Cerrito, so it's for me to overwater something, it doesn't take much.
Did you hurt it?
It died, actually.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I thought I was doing well because I had just moved to New Mexico, so I thought, oh, this needs water. And it's actually rotted because penstemons do not take much water.
Very interesting. So drought-tolerant plants are actually water-intolerant sometimes?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, they just don't need the water.
So what does this Native Plant Society of New Mexico, what do you do?
Well, the Native Plant Society of New Mexico is a group of volunteers. We have one part-time administrative assistant, but we have eight chapters throughout the state. These are chapters that are run pretty much on their own, and then the state organization is sort of an umbrella for them. We have chapters in Albuquerque and Otero and Taos and Santa Fe, and we even have a chapter in El Paso, and we also have a group in Colorado, because they have more in common with the New Mexico plants than they do with the rest of Texas or with the rest of Colorado. So they come for our annual meetings and our plant meetings. So we have about 800 members throughout the state, okay, and as I said, Colorado and Texas. Now, in 1976, the society was formed by a group of people who met in Santa Fe from all over the state. So this is actually our 35th anniversary of the founding of the society. So we produce a newsletter, we promote workshops, we have field trips. Every chapter is fairly autonomous, and they do workshops and field trips all over the state to educate people about plants. We also have a grants program. In each January, the board meets to decide how to fund different grants. Over the years, we've probably given nearly $200,000 to scientists, to schools, to nature centers, to a variety of different people who are working on conserving native plants.
What are the dangers that native plants face?
people. No, the native plants face a variety. I mean, it's climate change. It's destruction of habitat. It's overgrazing. It's drought. It's a number of things. It's development, too many people in an area. I mean, there's the weed, invasive weeds. Invasive weeds are taking over an incredible part of the American West. And so when you disturb an area, that's when you get a weed to come in. If you go to a natural area, the more pristine it is, the more non-disturbed it is, the less invasive weeds you'll see.
Very interesting. Why is
because
that? What's
the,
that
the
dynamic?
Well, the native plants actually have the place occupied. And it's only when you disturb it through putting roads through it, putting trails through it. That's why you often see weeds along the edge of trails, but you walk into the forest, you won't see the weed because the native plants have got that area contained.
Interesting. What are some of the weeds? I mean, would we recognize them, the non-botanists among us?
Well, I mean, there's the big weeds of the salt cedars and the things that people think about.
Oh, like those big trees.
Like those big trees, yeah, and Russian olives. I mean, I'd done some work at the Leonora Curtin wetland area south of Santa Fe, and Russian knapweed is a huge problem that's taking over some of the wetter areas. And it's nearly impossible to get rid of. I mean, it's these when these weeds come in, and it's interesting that a lot of the invasive weeds were given sort of Russian-Soviet names when they were given their common names.
Is this a Cold War thing?
I think it is a Cold War thing.
That's
hilarious. It was that these weeds were, you know, invasive and they were here, and so it's Russian knapweed and Russian olive and all these sort of things. So it's kind of charming, but a little horrifying also.
Russian olives aren't from Russia?
No. They're from Asia, but they're not really from Russia. So these names were just given to them.
It is funny because when I first, I'm not much of a gardener, but I have made attempts at gardening at different times, and flowers, weeds, gardening, etc., does lend itself to a certain amount of metaphorical constructs about invasion and cultivation and things
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, and control and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and of course, in, for example, the American South, kudzu apparently is eating everything. I mean, taking over everything.
Right, yeah. You can see pictures of it just climbing over buildings and devouring things.
What about juniper?
The junipers are native in New Mexico. So they're fairly drought tolerant, so they've done very well. They have increased, however, because of overgrazing. Just like the cholla's are native here, but there's way more cholla now than there used to be, because when you overgraze, those are the plants that are the cholla seedlings are not going to be eaten by the cattle, so then they're going to grow.
Right.
So you have a lot more cholla.
Very interesting. And so even native plants can get out of proportion.
Exactly. If things are not in balance, even native plants can get out. Can get out of proportion. They can. You can have what we call too much of a good thing of a native plant. But don't quote me on that.
Sorry, you're on the radio.
I'm on the radio.
Well, I mean, people do complain about the junipers,
right,
as an example.
Exactly, because of the pollen, because of the allergies that it provides.
Right.
Yeah.
What are the problem? I mean, do you have the way you have endangered mammal species and reptile species and so on? Do you have endangered plant species that are protected?
Yes. I mean, there's a whole system set up to protect endangered and threatened species of plants. There are endangered and threatened species, and then there are federal threatened and endangered species. So each state is responsible at the state level. And then the federal government provides funds when they're available to protect the federally threatened species. In fact, one of the field trips that we had scheduled for our conference, as you might imagine, with the recent fires and the drought and the forest closures, a number of our field trips have had to be changed. Okay, we did have one going out to Holy Ghost Canyon in Pecos, where there's the endangered Holy Ghost Ipomopsis. It's a federally endangered plant. And we were going to go out to look at it. But that area has been closed, so we've had to rethink some of our field trips.
Now, when there's a fire, especially the kind of very hot burning fire that we've had, I would think that, I mean, even very hardy seeds may not survive.
Well, for the most part, with native plants, unless it's a really hot fire, some of the seeds should survive, okay? I mean, I was talking to Terry Fox, Terry Lee Fox, I think. She is a scientist up at Los Alamos. She's going to be giving one of our field trips entitled Once the Smoke Clears. We added this. So she's going to be taking people up to Los Alamos to look at spots that were burned in the Cerro Grande fire years ago and showing the restoration and what's happened to those areas. And she makes the point that these fires burn at different intensities based upon the land use history of that piece of property. So if it was well managed, then it's not going to be burning as hot. It just depends on the
And if they've been doing fire suppression for 7 decades,
then
you're in trouble.
Then you're in trouble. Then you don't get things coming up and you have to go in and reseed right away. So we've had to rethink some of our field trips. Part of the interesting thing about the conference that's at the IAIA is that we have Friday talks, and then on Saturday morning we have field trips, and then all day Sunday we have field trips. People come from all over the state for this meeting, and they really want to... It's a great organization to belong to because you get to see different natural habitats around the state. You get to go with an expert who knows the local flora, who can tell you all the plants, who can talk about them. And because we've had a number of closures of areas, we've been scrambling to try to find other sites. So we're actually sticking a little closer to home,
yeah.
Doing riparian, doing places that are near the Santa Fe River, doing places a little wetter that we can see something.
And, of course, the study of plants naturally leads to the study of all the species in that particular area because various animals eat plants, plants have an effect on river areas, and so on.
Absolutely. At the Institute of American Indian Arts, I teach ethnobotany. And so we deal a lot with what are the local plants, how are they used, what is their history, what's the relationship with people. And so it's a wonderful place to teach that sort of interconnectedness between plants and people.
Tell us more about ethnobotany.
It's ethnobotanists. I mean, the study of plants and people. People are adding a lot of different elements to it now, sort of the insects and the plants and some of the animals. One of the sessions we're having at the conference on Saturday afternoon is on native pollinators. So we have a world's bee expert, a world's moth expert, and Steve Carey, the local world butterfly expert. So they're all going to be talking on the local insects, the native insects, and what we can do to promote those insects and keep them around.
What are some of the important native insects to preserve?
Well, I need an entomologist to go over that. I can quickly read Steve Carey's description.
In other words, it's important... Primarily because of the pollinating aspects?
Exactly. It's primarily because of the pollinating aspects. I mean, many of our native plants, if we lose our native pollinators, we then will lose our native plants.
Right.
Because without those insects to pollinate those plants are gone.
And depending on what you're talking about, you can also lose fruit and all kinds of things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's the danger of losing. That's why it was... You know, the recent scare about the colony collapse disorder with the bees,
right.
And what that would bring about if we actually lost our bees. Just the billions of dollars worth of food we would lose. All the interesting food we eat is pollinated by bees.
Right.
You know, we'd be eating, you know, corn and rice. I mean, there's just not a lot of stuff.
That isn't pollinated. Back to the concept that has come up many times, namely ecosystem services. The bees are doing that work for free.
Exactly. They're doing it for free. And we want to promote the native insects. And
right.
that's what some of these talks will be about.
Now, do we have non-native invasive insects too?
Well, the honeybees. I mean, they are European honeybees.
Ah.
They are not native to America.
They're pollinating.
They're pollinating and they're doing a very good job.
Are they a problem?
They're a problem in certain areas where they have taken over the resources that the native bees would use. Okay? And sometimes there are just so many of them that they crowd out the native bees. So it is a problem. I mean, it can be a problem.
We're talking to Dr. Tom Antonio about the Native Plant Society of New Mexico and their upcoming annual meeting and conference. So you are a botanist by trade. What do botanists do? Excuse the naive question.
Okay, botanists don't tell you how to grow plants. They tell you how plants grow. And so that's the difference between a botanist and a horticulturist. So when I was initially, when I finished my undergraduate degree in botany and I went home for the summer, My father says, I'm having trouble with the peach tree. What should we do? And I said, I really don't know. I could tell you all about the peach, the origin of the peach, you know, but I really can't help you with this peach tree. In which he said, well, what have I spent all that money for if you can't even help me with my peach tree? But botanists really deal with the systems of plants, how plants reproduce, how plants do their physiology, how plants absorb nutrients. They really deal with a wide range of things about plants.
They also go around discovering plants.
Yes, yes. In fact, there was a recent discovery in New Mexico, and I'm searching my brain. It was named by Robert Savinsky, who's going to be one of our speakers at the conference. Yeah, in fact, New Mexico is one of the New Mexico is one of the more under-collected states in terms of plants because of its ruralness and because of the lack of roads in certain areas and because of the amount of land.
The very thing that makes those habitats intact makes them hard to access.
Makes them hard to access. And so they're actually finding new plants in New Mexico with some regularity. And that's not the case in, you know, places like Ohio.
Right. So you are teaching at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and you've taught in other places. What is it like to teach native plant information and history and so on to native students? Are they coming from a different place than other colleges?
Right. They're coming. I mean, to me, it's been really interesting. When I taught at the College of Santa Fe, I would have to try to get people interested in plants, get them motivated to even know anything about plants. My students come in with a reverence and an understanding and an appreciation of plants. For the most part, the majority of the students come in having that already. I mean, they really come in with a core love of plants, a core respect for plants that my Anglo students did not have.
And presumably, I guess, some knowledge of their use.
Oh, for sure, for sure. In fact, I learn a lot from my native students about how their local tribes, their local communities use particular plants.
What are some examples of that?
Okay, well, even as we're walking around on field trips and I'm pointing out plants, I'll have students that are either from the Santo Domingo Pueblo say to me, oh, we use that plant for healing coughs. We use that plant for this. This is not something that I knew that plant was used for. I mean, and that sort of knowledge varies from community to community in the Native American group. So this particular plant may be used for something here, but may be used for a different thing in Arizona. It's very interesting. I mean, the sort of usage of plants in that culture is phenomenal.
A friend of mine had an infection under her fingernail, and doctors couldn't cure it. It just got worse and worse. And a Native friend of hers said, oh, melt some pinyon sap and put it on there for a day, and when she took it off, the infection was gone. There must be things like that that you find out all the time.
Yeah, I do. It's just fascinating to hear this. I also get played jokes on. You know, we were going out one day to look at trees, and one of my Diné students says, well, you know, Navajos don't cut trees in the cold. And I was like, what? I mean, she was playing a joke on me because you really didn't want to go outside in the cold. So, I mean, I have to be careful about, you know, what I do.
Right, like the anthropologists who go into the rainforest and the people have seen anthropologists before and they tell them every possible story under the sun.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. So it's been wonderful, and I learn as much from my students, I'm sure, as they learn from me.
So the people who are members of the Native Plant Society, are they primarily gardeners?
You know, I would say they're not primarily gardeners. I could be wrong about this.
Maybe those people join the Horticulture Society.
They join the Horticulture Society. They join the Botanical Garden Society. These are people who really like to get out into the wild, get out and see the plants. So there's nothing, I mean, if you go on a field trip with a group of Native Plant Society people, when the car stops, they scatter and they're looking at everything that you could possibly think of and naming them all. We have a very knowledgeable group of people in the Native Plant Society. If you actually sign up to lead a trip for us, you have to know what you're doing, because there'll be a lot of other people correcting you on your Latin plant names if you don't have them right. So it's an intense group, but a group that really appreciates and values native plants.
Are there many scientists in it?
Yes, we have a number of scientists because we give grants, because these botanists are all over the state. We have people coming in from New Mexico State University and from the University of New Mexico to give talks. They are members. The society also provides funds each year to the major herbaria in the state. There are five major herbaria. Now, herbarium is a place where you have dried, pressed specimens of plants. And New Mexico is fortunate to have five very good herbaria. And unfortunately, these are thought of as a very antiquated, old system of study, okay? But we actually give some funds each year to help promote the continuance of that practice. In other words, that's going out and pressing the plant in a plant press, mounting it on with glue onto the sheet with the correct label. It's actually a library, a press library of plants. It represents the knowledge of the world of plants on these sheets.
Now, you're saying that's an old-fashioned way of doing things?
Well, there are some molecular biologists and others who think that's an old-fashioned way of doing things.
But, I mean, if you're in a university and you're a botanist and you find a new plant and you have to classify it and make it available to the world, are you using those methods?
You are using those methods. That's what you have to do. Yeah, for the most part. I mean, you're also going to be using molecular biology, other tools as they become available. But you first have to get out and collect the plant and see what it looks like and look what it looks like morphologically. So the society does help promote the establishment and the maintenance of the herbaria in the state.
So once again, the Native Plant Conference annual meeting sponsored by the Native Plant Society of New Mexico is this coming August 5th through 7th, Thursday through Sunday at IAIA, Institute of American Indian Arts. And why should people come? Let's say somebody has some vague interest, but there's never been to any of your meetings before.
Well, aside from having an incredible roster of speakers that are giving interesting talks that you don't have to be a scientist to understand, I've asked each one of our speakers to speak generally and speak, you know, not to a scientific audience. So it's for local people. I'm going to be talking about local plants. We're going to be talking about the history of New Mexico, geology, and how that's affected plants. We have a speaker, Dr. Scott Collins from UNM, speaking on climate variability and how that's affecting plants in central New Mexico. So you'll learn a lot about a broad overview of plants, and then we have some very specific talks about local plants for your garden. We have a workshop on drawing plants if you're an illustrator. We have a number of wonderful field trips. And as I tell people, when I first moved to New Mexico, the first thing I did was join the Native Plant Society, and I immediately made a bunch of friends. So it's a great place to meet people who have similar interests and who appreciate and love plants.
Do you get involved with habitat preservation?
We do in some ways. I mean, we give money to organizations. We've given money to the Gila River Wilderness Restoration, even though I have that title wrong. In other words, they could monitor off-road vehicles that are going into the area. We've given money to schools so they can plant native plant gardens. We've done a lot to try to preserve the plants and help replace the native plants.
The Native Plant Society of New Mexico has a website, which is npsnm.unm.edu, or you can more likely just Google it, and we'll link to it on our website as well. Dr. Tom Antonio is science coordinator at the Institute of American Indian Arts here in New Mexico and president of the Native Plant Society, and we will see you at the Native Plant Conference.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.